Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order for March 1st, 2012 at 1:32. With me today, Senator Giesel, Senator Pascvan, Vice Chair, and arriving soon, Senator Menard and Senator Davis. We have a lot of items on the agenda today, so I'm going to try to get this thing underway and moving. We have Senate Bill 90, R-190, Big Game Commercial Services Board, as a further referral to Judiciary, sponsored by Senator Linda Menard, and presented by Mike Rovito's staff. And it's our intention to move the bill today. Senate Bill 116, Workers' Comp Collective Bargaining Mediation, sponsored by the Labor and Commerce Committee, has a further referral to Finance, and Dana Owen of staff to Labor and Commerce Committee will present a CS, and Senator Giesel also has an amendment. It's also our intention to move this bill. Then we're going to hear Senate Bill 199, Vocational Education Funding Factor, and that bill has no further referral. Senator Meyer is the sponsor, and we will take public testimony. And talking about public testimony, we're going to try to limit it to 2 minutes today because we have a lot of bills in our committee right now that we're trying to get rid of, get out of committee. Positively. And Senator Meyer is the sponsor. Edra Morledge will be presenting for Senator Meyer. Again, we'll take public testimony. Hear it, and it's the committee's intention to move Senate Bill 199 today as well. Then House Bill 168, Injunction Security Industrial Operations, has a further referral to Judiciary. Representative Feige is the sponsor. Linda Hay will present the bill. And then Senate Bill 217, Pharmacy Audits, has a further referral to Finance. Dana Owen, again, staff to Senate Labor and Commerce, will present the bill. And we intend to hear public testimony, but we may not get through it because we have such a long schedule today. So it's the intention of the committee to hear and hold the bill. And if we need additional public testimony, if we don't complete it, we'll do it as soon as possible. So, and welcome to Senator Menard. Welcome to the committee. So, bills previously heard and held and scheduled now for hopefully moving the bill out of committee. Senate Bill 190, Big Game Commercial Services Board. Mr. Oviedo. And we welcome Senator Davis. So we have a full committee again today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Michael Rovito, Chief of Staff, Senator Linda Menard. I don't really have anything to add to last meeting's testimony. I just want to reiterate that the Big Game Commercial Services Board spent about a year working on the changes that went into this bill so we could move them forward through legislation, and they've been a big help to us and in the support that they've gained behind the bill. I didn't know if there was any additional questions we could clear up, but I wanted to thank the committee and on behalf of the senator, thank the committee for hearing the bill and look forward to it moving.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Rovito. Further comments, Senator Menard? Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that we move the CS for Senate Bill 190 version /M from this committee to the next committee, a referral with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note, which I see is zero.
Great. Thank you, Senator Pascal, and I remove my objection. Is there objection? Seeing none, we'll take a brief at ease. reconvene Senate Labor and Commerce Committee for March 1st back to order at 1:38. And I just wanted to recognize former Representative Karen Robinson in the audience. And nice to have you here, Karen. Senate Bill 116, Workers' Compensation, Collective Bargaining, Mediation, sponsored by the Labor and Commerce Committee, has a further referral again to Finance. And Senator Passman.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we bring the CS for Senate Bill 116, identified as version /X, before this committee for purposes of discussion.
Great. Thank you, Senator Passman. And Dana Owen of the committee will present the CS. Mr. Owen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Dana Owen, staff to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. The CS that you have before you does a number of things. Mostly, it clarifies issues that have been brought up in a previous hearing on the bill, and then it adds one additional item that we had not discussed but that had been brought forward to us, and I'll explain those as I get there. I'd like to walk you through the bill, but I would I have to say before I do that that in certain cases, we've actually not simply added things to the bill, but we've actually picked things apart and scattered them. So it may be a little bit difficult to follow. And I'm happy to try and excuse me, clarify with any questions if you have them afterwards. To begin with, we've expanded the title. The first three lines of the bill adds an act authorizing employers and employees to mediate disputed workers' compensation claims and to negotiate a collective bargaining agreement that offers mediation and mandates arbitration. The remainder of the title remains the same. And again, that's as most titles do. It just wants to clarify what's in the rest of the bill, or to outline what's in the rest of the bill. Section 1 of the bill remains the same as in the original bill. The changes begin in Section 2, Collective Bargaining Agreements. Subsection A of the new bill expands the language in A1 of the previous bill and provides more details of the appeals process. Pardon me. The changes begin on line 28. Where the bill establishes a process for resolving disputes under this chapter through mediation or arbitration or both. A process established under this paragraph must provide that the parties must agree before a particular dispute may be submitted to mediation. And then if mediation fails, it provides for arbitration. It's nice to have an employer who looks after you.
Excuse me. As long as that doesn't infer any of the others at the table.
Yeah. That's right.
See, where was I? Okay. I wanted to point out that the lines 2 and 3 of page 2 specify that the arbitration will be conducted under AS 0943. Title 9 is the Code of Civil Procedure, and Chapter 43 is arbitration. Those specific sections that are cited, 300 to 595, constitute Article 3, the Revised Uniform Arbitration Act. We heard testimony in the last hearing, and there were questions from members of the committee that there was some confusion over how the arbitration was to take place. And it was the suggestion of the drafter, and we concurred, that it would be probably most direct to simply establish the arbitration as taking place under AS 0943. Because it's a section that attorneys are familiar with, it's a section that courts are familiar with, and the process is spelled out very clearly. It's something that everybody that will be involved in this should be fairly familiar with. I would point out too that by placing it under 0943, It also spells out or implies an appeals process that will differ from the Workers' Compensation Act. In the case of the current Workers' Compensation Act, you have an appeal to the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission. This will obviate that, and appeals will no longer go to the Workers' Compensation Commission. That was the original intent of the bill, but this will clarify that. The bill goes on to specify that mediation or arbitration will govern the dispute resolution process under this chapter, to clarify that, and also says the dispute resolution process must result in findings of fact, award, and a final order or decision by the arbitrator. And that award, order, or decision has the same force and effect as a finding of fact, award, order, or decision of a hearing officer under AS 2330-005. That section of statute is the Workers' Compensation Board. So the arbitrator's ruling under a collectively bargained agreement will have the same effect and force as an issue of an order of the board. Subsection B, which is on line 25, begins on line 25 of your CS, guarantees that benefits under Chapter 2330, which is the Alaska Workers' Compensation Act, cannot be bargained away. That's the meaning of the language. It further clarifies that the agreement and processes negotiated under this law cannot themselves be considered a reduction of benefits. Subsection C, which begins on 30, line 30, ensures that physicians can meet and communicate with parties to a negotiation in the process of establishing lists of physicians who are the exclusive medical providers in a collectively bargained agreement. Currently, physicians are prevented by law from agreeing or from collaborating on contracts, negotiations, fees, and things like that. We have a very narrow exception to that carved out in statute, and this would be the only other exception in statute to that. Currently, it's the physicians are allowed to do that if they're negotiating with a the term of art is escaping me, a managed benefits organization. Senator Giesel can probably know what I'm talking about. I'm sorry, I just lost the term of art. But this would allow the physicians to be able to talk to one another if they're going to try and get on the list that would be the list that would be established under a collectively bargained agreement under this statute. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to try and answer questions, but I've also been handed a note that Dennis Bailey, who is the drafter of the bill, is online to help clarify things.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Rowan. I was just brought you water because I thought you were going to be able to get through the CS. we're just trying to save you, Dana.
Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Owen from the committee? Seeing none, Dana, thank you very much. Questions, Mr. Bailey, are you online?
Yes, I am online.
Great, thank you.
I'd be happy to answer questions if anyone has one.
Great, thank you, Dennis. Questions from the committee for Mr. Bailey, the drafter? Seeing none, great, thank you very much for providing your services just in case. And you may want to stick around.
Mr. Chairman, I will.
Mr. Bailey.
I just want to say that if you give me a moment, I'll pass out the amendment that Senator Giesel has offered.
Great. Thank you, Dan. Now, we do have an amendment presented by Senator Giesel, and Sharon Long of Senator Giesel's staff will come forward, and Ms. Long will present the amendment. Thank you, Sharon.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome. Senator Giesel.
Before Sharon begins, I just wanted to precede the presentation of the amendment by saying, as a healthcare provider, my overarching concern is always a patient's choice, the ability of a person to choose one of the most intimate aspects of their lives, and that's their healthcare. So that's what this amendment pertains to, which Dana is passing out.
Great. Thank you very much, Senator Giesel. Ms. Long. Well, let's wait till we get there.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you for staying around, Sharon. If you can present, please.
Good afternoon, Chairman Egan and Senators.
This amendment, go to page 3 of your CS, and the changes we propose, oh, for the record, my name is Sharon Long. I'm staff to Senator Kathy Geisel. So down in the middle of page 3, lines 13 through 15, delete all that language. It will show up again later. The second change begins on line 26. Right after the word not, insert the number 1. And then at the end of that line, delete for the purposes of this subsection, and instead place, instead of that phrase, put for the purposes of this paragraph. Down on...
Chairman?
Senator Bernard.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm having a hard time following. Could we go back up to on page 3,
uh-huh.
line 26,
uh-huh.
The following not, insert...
The number 1. We're going to end up here having a 1 and a 2, and this is the 1.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
And delete then on that line for the purposes of this subsection and insert for the purposes of this paragraph. And then go down to line 29 and we're going to insert a 2 after the word chapter. And just that language that we crossed off up there in 13, 14, and 15, we're going to insert that language. Identify health care providers who are the exclusive source of medical treatment provided under this chapter. In this paragraph, health care provider has the meaning given in AS 0955-560. The last change is on line 30 through line 4 on the next page, and just delete that. So delete line 30 and 31 on page 3. Flip over to page 4 and delete those first 4 lines. And as my senator said, this preserves the right currently in statute for injured workers to choose their own health care provider.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Long. Questions for Ms. Long or the sponsor?
I guess I, yes.
Senator Pascran.
It's my understanding now that there are generally exclusive providers that are designated under plans. And so is this, I guess, one, is that basic premise true? And assuming that it is, does this then prohibit that in the future?
Senator Geisel or Ms. Long?
What this does, and of course Mr. Bailey is online to answer questions, but the main purpose of this is to allow the patient to choose whichever health care provider they want to. In other words, their private physician, or if they're part of a plan that designates, but this is addressing a collective bargaining agreement, not your general person that's not part of a collective bargaining agreement. This doesn't have any effect on them. This affects only those folks that are in a collective bargaining agreement and allows them to choose their position.
Senator Pascran.
And again, I'm starting with the general premise. My belief is for example, if you want to go to a dentist, there are dentists that the state of Alaska has said are on the list, and those dentists have agreed with the state of Alaska that they'll do a cavity for $100 or whatever it is.
Yes.
So my question is that going to, with that premise as a starting point, would this prohibit the state of Alaska for negotiating with dentists to get a lower collective price of the service? Because I understand that's what the whole purpose of it is. And so some dentists, and I'm not picking on dentists for any profession, but some choose to participate and some choose not to participate, and that is, so to speak, the forces of capitalism at that choice level, but relying upon the employer to drive the price down for the employee. So that's my concern.
It was not the intent to do that, but I think Mr. Bailey could probably answer that best.
Yeah, Mr. Bailey, if you could answer Senator Passavant's question and also a follow-up if this interferes at all with the title.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Passavant, I think that the, well, I'm not quite sure where to start. The focus of the bill allows a employer and their employees in a union to negotiate a mediation and an arbitration process. And as a part of that process, they are allowed to negotiate the selection of health care providers that would be permitted to provide services to the union members under the collective bargaining agreement. So Section 2 says that they can negotiate that. And your question is, it's just because under the normal operation of the workers' compensation statute that allows employers to negotiate with healthcare providers to provide services under their workers' comp coverage, doesn't really, it's not really affected by the bill. The bill is restricted to the concept of negotiating different terms under the provisions of the collective bargaining agreement. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Senator Passavant.
The short answer is no, or I'm confused. But the question is that if you allow full choice to the employee, and the employee goes to a dentist that charges $150 as compared to a contracted dentist that charges $100, who pays the $50?
Okay, I think that the question, I don't want to say it misses the point, because under the existing workers' comp statute, outside of a collective bargaining agreement, the current law provides that the employee who makes a claim can choose their health care provider, and they can also choose an alternate, so that the issue really is choosing who your health care provider is. And there may be circumstances where an employer chooses the health care provider for an employee under who makes a claim, but that's limited to the circumstance where the employee doesn't make their own choice. Now, it may be that the employer can negotiate with a group of physicians or a particular physician to provide that in the circumstance where the employer appoints the physician. But the general rule is that the employee gets to choose their own physician in workers' comp. So the question of negotiating a lower rate really is more applicable to a health care plan, yeah, not within the context of a workers' comp claim. And I'll leave it at there.
And then just one
best friend.
I understand that distinction, and I'll think about that some more. But then the provision where it talks about competing physicians may meet and communicate, again, my understanding is that is with respect to whether they are participants in an exclusive source agreement with an employer. And as my perception is that the concern is that if you have competitors meeting, you have price fixing, and that by allowing competitors to meet, what is the effect of that? Does that make sense?
Okay.
Ms. Braley.
Yes. Senator Passavant, through the chair. The purpose of allowing physicians to communicate concerning a providing services by the group is intended, I think, and under 2350 has the general provisions that allow that. It allows physicians to get together and say, we want to provide the services for X amount of dollars as a group. In the absence of a provision like that, whoever is negotiating with the physicians could go and negotiate with each physician and pit one physician against another physician to negotiate a lower price from the physicians. So this balances or the negotiating power of physicians with the whoever is attempting to get their services. Now, it's included in this bill because the bill provides for a negotiation of who the service who the medical providers are. And in that negotiation, physicians presumably would want to be able to negotiate as a group, not negotiate individually. So that's the purpose of Section C. I'll leave it there.
Great. Thanks to you, Mr. Bailey. Senator Giesel.
The amendment, however, would remove that section so that the physicians could, competing physicians could not meet and communicate in order to negotiate collectively with the party. So they would be negotiating independently.
If I can interrupt.
Yes.
Mr. Bailey.
The amendment says or takes out the provision that the who is the health provider can be negotiated. So the law, the bill in version X says that you can negotiate a physician or a group of physicians who are going to provide services to the employees under the collective bargaining agreement. Okay, and the amendment says we don't want you to negotiate who the physicians are. We want the existing method that allows an individual to choose their own provider to apply instead. So Section 2 comes out. Section 2 says that they can negotiate it. The amendment says they can't negotiate it. So if there's no health I shouldn't say health care, but medical service provided by a doctor, then there's nothing for the doctors to negotiate. So that's why the amendment takes Section C out.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Bailey. Ms. Long, looked like you had something to say.
And please correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Bailey, but our amendment takes away the ability to bargain away one's right to choose your physician. But it doesn't change the ability of physicians to get together and decide to provide a service through an employer at certain rates. It's only bargaining away that ability in a bargaining agreement.
Mr. Bailey.
If that, I just wanted to be sure that was a question toward me.
Yes.
I think
now it is to you.
It doesn't take away the provisions of the physicians under 2350.020 outside of a bargaining agreement.
That statement, through the chair, Senator Pascavan, Ms. Long, the 2350 allows that under certain circumstances. It allows physicians to negotiate as a group. By the only way, the only reason that it was included in the bill originally was as it applies to the section that allows negotiating of physicians, providing physician services under the collective bargaining agreement. If you take that out of the collective bargaining agreement context, it does not affect the remainder of the 2350, which relates to bargaining by physicians. So it just makes it so it doesn't apply here because we're no longer including, or under the amendment, it would no longer include negotiating with a physician.
Okay, Senator Geisel, then Senator Pasvan.
Dana referred to a managed care group, okay, and so that provision is still there for physicians to negotiate as a managed care plan, so that's not affected in those kinds of scenarios. It's only as it relates to this disputed workers' comp.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Pasvan.
Okay, and again, I'm trying to be very cautious here because this is important to understand. But first of all, I understand that a group of physicians could agree, but for example, that's why they would form a business and you could have 10 physicians. But the operative term here is competing physicians. And the question is if they're a group, but they're formed as one, then they're not in competition with each other. But the question is that second one or that second group, if they are competing, how does that affect this analysis?
Mr. Bailey?
Senator Pasvan, through the chair. Well, you have to keep it in the context of this bill, which relates to collective bargaining for mediation, okay, and collective bargaining to decide who the health care providers are for the union or for the employees. So in that context, when the collective bargaining agreement allows for, and it's not mandated, but allows for designating a certain group of physicians or certain physicians to provide medical services, then the provisions of C apply. And they basically say, if you're going to provide services under this collective bargaining agreement that designates who the physicians are, you can negotiate that along the same lines as existing 2350 allows you to. 2350 allows that under certain circumstances. So by taking that section out, you're just saying that it doesn't apply here because we're not selecting a particular physician that's going to provide services. So this negotiating opportunity for physicians doesn't really apply anymore. So I'll leave it there.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Baylor. Senator Pasquin.
One follow-up on that. So when we look at the amendment lines 13 through 17, what that says is that the agreement may not identify health care providers who are the exclusive source of medical treatment. So that's
exclusive.
Hmm?
Right. Exclusive.
But the inference is that there is a list of exclusive source. You just can't give the employee who they are. And is that a misunderstanding?
I believe so, but I'm not sure I understood the question. I'm sorry.
In other words, is there an exclusive source agreement? In other words, if there's no exclusive source agreement, then there's nothing to identify. So why put an amendment in that they cannot identify the list if they've never put a list together? That's my confusion.
And Mr. Bailey can correct me if I'm incorrect here, but this bill deals with a disputed workers' comp claim issue, okay? Mm-hmm. So we're talking about collective bargaining agreements that would identify healthcare providers who are an exclusive source. In other words, the individual injured worker would now be confined to an exclusive list who may or may not include his or her own personal health care provider. And that is the piece that the amendment would remove. It would allow them to go to their own health care provider. There is no exclusive source.
Great. Thank you, Senator Geisel. I guess I'm concerned that we're going to pass this out and not have all the answers.
We're not
going
to pass it out until we understand
that right,
what the
right.
amendment is.
And what I would like to do is, and I understand that you, there are, the Senate, in all essence, is going to be shut down for most of the week next week, and this would delay the bill. But I feel strong enough that because the whole piece of legislation is deviating from the norm as we have it right now, and it's a major piece of legislation. And I want to make sure that the committee has all the answers and that Senator Diesel can work.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Davis.
Mr. Bailey's on the line. He did not answer the question. She asked him to answer. He did not answer. I'd like to hear what the answer is. If he gives the right answer, we could probably move on and see what we're going to do with the amendment. If they don't agree, there's a problem.
That's true, but I think we have issues with the amendment right now. I would like to take another week and get it right, and because I think there are some good points that Senator Giesel pointed out. But I don't have all the answers, and I would like to talk to folks at Labor and different folks that are involved in this to make sure that there wasn't an issue with the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a problem
Senator
with
Davis.
That, but I still think while we are here, he's on the line, he can answer the question. At least that's, I have an understanding of what she's trying to do, and he agreed, and that's what this amendment would do.
Mr. Bailey.
And if it doesn't, then there would be no need to address this. We still make the changes or do whatever need to be done.
I understand. Thank you, Senator Davis. Mr. Bailey.
Mr. Chairman, I think if you encapsulate the amendment, it does one thing, and it removes the negotiation of medical providers under the collective bargaining agreement. So you can't negotiate who the providers would be. And it takes out Section 2, and it adds it again down below that says you can't do that. So it's sort of it comes out in one section that says you can, and it puts it in another section that says you can't. Maybe that's redundant, but it makes it clear. And yet the result of that is that the provisions of the existing workers' comp statute, which allows you to choose your own treating physician in a claim, during a claim, would continue to apply as they normally do. Section C, which is the section about competing physicians negotiating, doesn't apply anymore, because there wouldn't be any specified physicians under the collective bargaining agreement. That's a thumbnail sketch of the amendment.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Bailey. Senator Davis, further questions for Mr. Bailey?
I don't have any questions.
Senator Pascavant.
To make sure I follow it. So this removes any negotiation between an employer and physicians with respect to providing services, and does it then mean that the employer has no one with whom they can negotiate reduced prices as a package for their employees because there's no one to negotiate with?
I think Mr. Bailey should.
That's who I'm addressing.
Mr. Bailey.
Mr. Bailey.
Yes. Senator Pascavant, through the chair, I think that the issue is being clouded a little bit by your question, because the employer and the employee under the bill, under the existing bill without the amendment, negotiate that term. They say these are the people that we want to provide the services. Now, if you remove this section, there isn't going to be a negotiation under the collective bargaining agreement for selecting particular employees, so that the employer wouldn't be in a position to negotiate with physicians about what they provide or what the cost of their services are. There are issues that are just kind of unrelated. I'm not sure if that helps or not.
Senator Pascavant.
If I may, no, and I agree that the conclusion that there's no price negotiation follows, but again, that's at a potential loss collectively to the employees, that the employers superior bargaining strength might be able to obtain for the employee.
Mr. Bailey.
Well, under the existing law, there's no negotiation by the employer for the cost of paying for the employee's position. And that wouldn't change, assuming the amendment passes. Under the bill, if the amendment does not pass and the provision is still in there, then both the employer and the employee negotiate that already in the collective bargaining agreement. They're not bound to negotiate it. It's just permissive. They can negotiate whether there are additional certain service providers to do that. So the amendment just says if you take that out, the existing law is going to apply, which doesn't really include negotiation of prices with the employers for services. So I think that the question is really kind of unrelated to the result of what would happen with the amendment. I mean, so, I suppose you could,
we're going to hold it.
I don't see the circumstance where the employer would negotiate that price.
Senator Giesel, final comment, because
it will be final comment. The strength of having an employee, an individual, a person, be able to choose their own health care provider is that they will be continuing to see that person and likely have seen them historically, so that that health care provider knows the individual, knows their condition, their physical condition, both before the injury, how they're progressing through it, their family history, things like that. And so it does help reduce the cost of health care and provide the best care possible for the injured worker. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you, Senator Giesel. It's my intention to hold the bill for one future meeting. We will get all these answers to the amendment, and then we'll act on the final bill, amended or not, in the CS. Ms. Long, thank you very much for taking the time. Dennis, thank you very much for staying online and providing testimony. Next is Senate Bill 199, Vocational Education Funding Factor. Has no further referrals. Sponsor Senator Kevin Meyer. Welcome to the committee room, Senator Meyer. And I understand that you have Edward Morledge of your staff to present the bill.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. We won't take up too much of your time. It's a pretty simple bill, actually, Senate Bill 199. As you may or may not recall, co-chair Senator Thomas and I introduced Senate Bill 84 last year, which created a separate funding factor for vocational education programs for grades 9 through 12. The voc ed funding was 1% of the BSA. And since this bill was signed and put in effect, Senate Bill 84 last year, the school districts have applauded us. It's been a good program. The only problem is it didn't include middle school. And Mr. Chairman, I mean, I can go on here, but that's all this bill does. It expands the program to include middle school.
Great. Thank you, Senator Meyer. I think it's a great piece of legislation. I guess I shouldn't say that. But
but you're a sponsor.
Yeah, Edward, you are a co-sponsor.
Well, I am. Well, that's why. Never mind. I didn't want to say that. Edward, did you have anything to add?
For the record, Edward Morledge, staff to Senator Meyer. I don't have any additional information to add. It is, as Senator Meyer said, it's just a real simple bill. A couple of changes, and the bill opens it up to middle school, and
That's a great idea. Thank you, Ms. Morledge. Questions from the committee for the sponsor or the presenter? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair, I move that we move Senate Bill 199.
Oh, by the way, Senator Pascal, we do have Les Morris from Department of Education for the Development in the audience to answer questions. Any questions for Mr. Morris? Senator Pascal.
Mr. Chair, I move that we move Senate Bill 199 version /A from this committee to the next committee, a referral with individual recommendations and attached.
Which is none.
It goes to rules.
Right.
So with attached fiscal note.
Is your objection?
Great.
Take a brief at ease. Thank you, Senator Meyer. and Senate Labor and Commerce. The next bill on the agenda is Senate Bill 168, but the sponsor is still testifying on another bill. So we are going to start Senate Bill 217, Pharmacy Audits, and we will try to spend a short amount of time on this bill, on Senate Bill 217, but we did want to provide the opportunity for some folks in the room to provide public testimony on House Bill 168. However, the sponsor is not available, so if it's okay with the committee, we'll start Senate Bill 217, Pharmacy Audits, and Mr. Owen of the committee will present.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hopefully I've recovered my voice. For the record, I'm Dana Owen. I'm staff to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Apparently I haven't recovered all of it yet. The issue of pharmacy audits has been brought to us numerous times in our office by local pharmacists. The bill that you have before you is identical, first of all, to the bill that's introduced into the other body by a representative from Juneau. And you'll hear testimony tonight about more about the issues involved, but I'd like to just read some remarks. Finally gotten around to scripting myself at some point. And hopefully I will stay on the right bill. Alaska pharmacists are being bombarded with audits from the pharmacy benefits management companies, commonly referred to as PBMs, insurance companies, and other state healthcare providers. Senate Bill 217 attempts to standardize the audit process in order to allow pharmacists to spend less time on paperwork and focus more time on patient health. Additionally, this legislation seeks to bring fairness to the unregulated and expanding practice of pharmacy audits by ending abusive practices that have harassed and harmed pharmacy businesses. While audits are a necessary and even welcome part of good business practice, pharmacy audits have become unduly burdensome and in many cases predatory. So acute has this problem become that national companies have been formed to help pharmacists with audits, recovering millions of dollars in inappropriate audit chargebacks. Senate Bill 217 will ease the burden on pharmacists by requiring uniform, common sense standards and criteria for all pharmacy audits, requiring written notice of at least 2 weeks before an on-site pharmacy audit, requiring that an on-site audit not interfere with the healthcare services being provided by pharmacists, by banning audits during the first 7 calendar days of each month when patient volume is highest, unless the pharmacy and the auditor agree otherwise. Senate Bill 217 will further eliminate the highly questionable practice of extrapolation as justification for taking back claim money. It will eliminate the unfair take-back of money in cases of simple typographical errors when no financial harm has occurred to the plan sponsor, the PBM, or patient. It will further require that audits involving clinical or professional judgment be conducted by or in consultation with a pharmacist licensed in the state. For small pharmacies especially, audit practices that have become common are much more than mere nuisances. The time and money lost can threaten the very viability of these businesses. Senate Bill 217 seeks to bring fairness and predictability back to the practice of pharmacy audits. Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to try and answer any questions, but I can tell you that there are many people here who know this topic much more thoroughly than
Great.
I.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Rowan. Questions for Mr. Rowan? Great, Jenna. Thank you very much. And we do have folks online or... Okay, well, we will start public testimony. Senator Pasfan.
Mr. Chair, I move that we bring Senate Bill 217, version / A, before Senate Labor and Commerce Committee for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Senator Pasfan. But we do have, and I'll object, we do have folks signed up to, a lot of folks signed up to testify. Excuse me, and if we can keep, again, your testimony to 2 minutes or less. First, we will go to the Fairbanks LIO, Margaret Soden, from the Alaska Pharmacists Association. Ms. Soden.
Thank you very much. I'm Margaret Soden, the immediate past president of the Alaska Pharmacists Association, and I'm currently mostly retired as a community pharmacist here in Fairbanks. When I first started out as a pharmacist 45 years ago, most patients paid cash for their prescriptions. Now the majority of prescriptions are billed to third parties, and along with that third-party billing has come audits of prescription records. Senate Bill 217 is just bringing some standardization and fairness into the audit process. The provisions of this bill will allow pharmacists time to comply with this audit request, but cause less disruption to the patient care that we provide in our pharmacies every day. And I'd like to thank you very much for allowing us this opportunity to tell you and to explain why we are asking for your support. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much for staying online, Ms. Soden. And we do have Barry Christensen on OffNet from Ketchikan, from the Alaska Pharmacists Association. Mr. Christensen, welcome.
Yep. Thank you very much, Chairman Egan and members of the committee. My name is Barry Christensen, and I am a pharmacist currently serving as co-chair of the Alaska Pharmacists Association Legislative Committee. I want to thank you, Senator Egan, for introducing, as a committee bill, this important legislation. Our association, the Alaska Pharmacists Association, represents pharmacists, pharmacies, and pharmacy technicians in the state of Alaska. Our members work hard every day in retail pharmacies, hospitals, nursing homes, and medical clinic settings throughout the state. We are here today to ask for your support for legislation before you that would help create a level playing field for pharmacists when dealing with pharmacy audits. Our membership has made this our number one legislative priority. At the onset, let me assure you that our association supports the needs for audits to ensure that fraud, waste, and abuse activities are checked. However, audits must be conducted in a fair and balanced manner, allowing for a fair appeal and payment for all services performed within the patient's insurance benefit structure. I know there are other pharmacists up to testify regarding their experience with pharmacy audits, so I'll keep my testimony short. However, I'd briefly like to outline how a typical prescription is processed and a record is generated so you have a feel for how an audit trail is produced. It was our intent to have a flow sheet available for you, and I think one may have been distributed earlier, but in summary, pharmacies generally contract with prescription benefit managers, or PBMs, in order to fill and bill for consumers as part of their health benefit plan. PBMs are pharmacy benefit managers. I believe you also have in your packet a listing of the top 50. Some of the names that you may have heard are names like Express Scripts, Medco, and Caremark. Nearly all prescriptions now are filled electronically in real time. That is, the pharmacy sends prescription information to the PBM, and in turn, the PBM sends back authorization for payment and other clinical edits of concern, for example, high dose warnings, drug interactions, etc. Pharmacies are reimbursed back for the cost of medication plus a dispensing or professional fee that covers the pharmacy's cost of doing business. Typically, either the PBM or an entity contracted by the PBM will perform audits on contracted pharmacies to legitimately protect against fraud and abuse. It has been suggested by some that pharmacies should be able to contractually deal with their auditing concerns directly with the PBMs. I wish it were this easy. Most Alaska pharmacists that I have spoken to have never been able to alter the terms of a contract given to them, except for perhaps the dispensing fees. It is usually a take-it-or-leave-it offer. That is why we are asking for some standardization and auditing practices that would be applicable to all plans and pharmacies in the state. Like I said, I know there's others waiting to testify, but I welcome your questions at this time.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Christensen. And we do. We have 12 other folks online at 2 minutes each. We'll make 24 minutes. And I apologize to Representative Feige, who I just see joining us in the committee room. And Representative Feige, we went ahead and started taking testimony on the next bill. And I apologize on behalf of the committee, but and we have 12 people signed up to testify, 2 minutes each. And the next to testify is Dirk White. Mr. White, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill today. My name is Dirk White. I'm a pharmacist from Sitka, Alaska. I serve with Barry as well in the Legislative Committee, and I am also Vice Chairman of the Pharmacy, State of Alaska Board of Pharmacy. And in your packet, you should have a letter that we, at our February meeting, we unanimously approved or support for the House bill, which the Senate bill had not been proposed yet and introduced. I would like to basically mirror everything that Barry said as well. It is very onerous, these tactics, these audits. One of the things that I wanted to clarify, it seems that the term that there are errors on these prescriptions, that they're bringing money back. There are no errors in the on these prescriptions. When you look at them as a Board of Pharmacy member, I would look at these as valid prescriptions, that the patient has received that prescription from their physician, they brought it to the pharmacist, we've filled it, it's been legally transposed, and it complies with the patient pharmacist triad, where the physician triad, where we've worked together and we've improved the health of the patient. But the PBMs on their own have come up with arbitrary means of reasons for bringing this up, and a lot of times it's fishing expeditions for more money for them. It does not just apply to pharmaceuticals. My wife and I just, she's a pharmacist as well and helps me work together. On Monday, we received a bench audit for a part of our business that deals with durable medical equipment, hospital beds, wheelchairs, oxygen concentrators. From 2008, we're requested to provide information for two wheelchairs. One of them was $3,500. The other one is $3,800. These prescriptions came to us from a physician. We had to measure, provide the wheelchair. The patients received the wheelchair. They received wonderful benefit from those. They were able to move around, get out of the house, do things on their own, and improve their quality of life. Now, if we cannot produce all the paperwork that the pharmacy benefit managers want, they'll take that money back. And it very well may close down that portion of the business, because we may have made $500 on each one of those wheelchairs. That's just an example for you. And I'll open myself for questions as well.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. White. And thank you for coming to town and testifying. Senator Pascha.
Yeah, and I have a general like for the bill. So my question really goes to the pharmacy benefits managers themselves. Is there any regulation or control on how much of the benefit is passed on? You know, they negotiate with the manufacturer. You know, how much of the savings is passed on to the employer consumer? You know, in other words, how transparent or opaque is that?
Senator Pascavan, through the chair, that is a question I really don't know. I'm not able to answer. Again, that's I don't see that. Again, it's not transparent to me, so I have no idea if any of that money even goes back to the insurance companies. I'd be speculating.
Thank you, Mr. White. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many other states have these kinds of sidebars on an audit process?
Senator Giesel, through the chair, I believe it's 15 now.
Okay.
But if that's not correct, I could get the correct number, but I believe it is 15, I believe.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Senator Giesel. Thank you, Mr. White. Senator Bernard.
And along that same line of questioning, so what are the other states doing? You would prefer at least a two-week notice before the audit. Personally, I think that's too little time. And is that general standard in these other states, that is it a two-week instead of just giving you a notice and saying?
Senator Marth, through the chair again, I would be speculating, but because this is model legislation that came from a national organization, National Community Pharmacy Association, and I would think that it's pretty very similar.
Okay.
But I agree with you.
And I'm assuming, Mr. White, that it's no time now.
Oh, they can drop in, but they generally do try and give us some notice.
An hour or two?
Well, it could be.
Or you know when the plane comes in.
Yeah.
So, right. Great. Thank you again. Senator Menard.
And I had a lot of clarity. We just met about an hour ago or so. But the one thing I'm still a little confused on, you said in some instances,
you'll write a prescription. The prescription from the physician is for 30 pills. But at some point you give 31 because they might be traveling or something, and then you get called in on that. Or could you just clarify that a little bit better? I certainly am a little fuzzy on why that's allowed.
Through the chair, yeah, that was, I think we may have been misspeaking on that one. I think it was, we might have been talking more about days supply, I think. In other words,
yes,
the prescription was for 30 tablets, and somebody may, a pharmacist may put it down as a 31-day supply, or possibly in, at times I've had a prescription come in where the physician has written for just a 30-day supply, and the patient has asked me, well, I'm going to be gone longer. Can I get more? In that case, I would call the physician and say, explain to him, they're going to be gone a little bit longer than out of town or out of, unavailable. Can we get an extra week or so, and or a couple extra days? And if it's for whatever reason, again, the PBMs may not like that. And
through the chair, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Menard.
That's the step I missed. So the physician is directing you that you may add one or two pills because they are going out. I thought you took it upon yourself, so I'm glad.
Well, that would be a violation.
Yeah,
That would be a violation of the Board of Pharmacy rules and regulations. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Great, thank you very much, Dirk. Next to testify, Cindy Lombacher, representing Medco. Ms. Lombacher, and if you can give your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Certainly. Mr. Chair and member, Cindy Lombacher, Senior Director of Government Affairs for Medco Health Solutions, and I am here today in opposition to this piece of legislation. Medco is one of the PBMs, or pharmacy benefits managers, that you've been hearing about this afternoon. We currently manage the pharmacy benefit for approximately 20% of the residents of Alaska. We are here today because we have a responsibility to our clients who rely on us to protect them from fraud, waste, and abuse in our pharmacy that may occur within our pharmacy network that they contract with us to use. The auditing of prescription claim reimbursements is a necessary component of participation in the prescription drug program. Our plan sponsors, which include labor unions, health plans, state government, federal government, they require us to perform a number of services, including monitoring of prescription claim reimbursements, conducting audits of prescription claims, and the recovery of overpayments to the pharmacy by the plan sponsor. We are required to audit not only to the State Board of Pharmacy rules, which was just referenced, but also to the plan requirements. So when we go in and do an audit, we're doing an audit not just for, let's say, the state of Alaska. When we're auditing for Medicare Part D, we're auditing for any number of our health plan clients and labor unions. There may be 30 clients that we're auditing for when we enter a pharmacy. Our pharmacy audit program focuses on a number of activities, including on-site and desk audits, patient and physician analysis of Medicare Part D claims, and claims analysis to identify potentially aberrant trends. Our clients ask us and demand of us to minimize the number of prescription claims that are inaccurate, involve fraud, waste, or abuse, and or are not in accordance with plan requirements. An effective audit program helps to protect the financial integrity of the pharmacy network by identifying those claims that resulted in overpayments and recovering overcharges where appropriate. And let me be clear there, because this issue came up previously. When we recover, we're recovering on behalf of our clients. The money doesn't go to us. It goes to this is money owed to our clients. So they are relying on us to recover that money for them.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Bernard.
I know you're talking real
fast.
I don't mean to interrupt, but does it not work like a collection agency? Even if though you're collecting, do you not have pay someone to go through that process to collect it?
Certainly, when a health plan or in our contracts, they hire. In Medco's case, our auditors are internal. We don't subcontract that out to anyone. So our auditors are paid pursuant to the contract and under the terms of the contract as set forth by the client. The client decides how it's paid for, not us. Does that? But yes, we do get paid to do it as pursuant to our contract.
Great.
Thank you. Just interject that kind of follows with Senator Menard's. What percentage of the audits are fraud? In other words, you're talking a lot about fraud, but what percentage of your audits are fraudulent? You know, where they, not the audits themselves, but they uncover fraud.
Senator Pascman, through the chair, I would have to get you a number on that. I'd have to go back to my auditors and ask that. It certainly does occur. It's a big problem in the Medicaid business. I'm sure you've heard about, you know, those stories are in the press all the time. We do quarterly analyses of all of our pharmacy network. We have a pharmacy network of some 58,000 pharmacies, and we do quarterly analyses to identify, to see if there's trends, but I don't know what the percentage is. I can find that out.
You know, what I understand is this is draft legislation that's been adopted by a national organization.
Correct.
So I assume that this language, you agree, does not violate Medicare or Medicaid. It doesn't violate those standards. Do you agree?
No. I apologize, Vice Chair Pascman, and through the chair. The rules under Medicare and Medicaid are much different than what is allowed for. You can go in and this would restrict how far back we can look. For example, this would restrict us to 24 months in Medicaid. We can go back 5 years and 10 years, I believe. And I believe there's an actual auditor on the phone who can answer that question. But it's one of the things that this is a model bill that NCPA has come up with, and we have seen it in a number of states. But they also typically exempt Medicare. This bill does not yet, but they typically exempt Medicare and Medicaid because they do have their own set of rules by which we are subject to follow.
Well, do you agree that to the extent Medicare or Medicaid operates, that federal standard would occupy the field, so to speak, where the state law cannot overrule the supremacy of the federal law? So in other words, we can do this, and it doesn't affect whatever you want to do under Medicare or Medicaid. This just, if we want to adopt this standard to protect Alaskans for the pharmacy practice here, that doesn't affect whatever you do in Medicare and Medicaid.
Senator Pascan, through the chair, that would be true. We typically see specific exemptions in the law, but we would argue that regardless if it's a claim that involves Medicaid or Medicare, it would not be subject to the statute.
Great, thank you. Further questions, Senator Pascan? Senator Giesel.
Well, my question is kind of along those same lines, Mr. Chair, and as I look at the sidebars that are placed on the audit, they seem quite reasonable. I mean, certainly pharmacies are incredibly busy the first 7 days of a month. What specifically would be inoperable for your company in terms of auditing?
Senator Giesel, through the chair, one of the problems we have with the particular time frame, there's two problems. One is lots of states are doing this. We have 15 states that have that are restricting that when we can go in and do an audit, which means that reduces the amount of time we have to go in to all pharmacies, basically. So you're taking one entire week out of the mix. With regard to the amount of notice, that has to do with preventing fraud. We do have instances where we notify someone that we're coming in to do an audit and they disappear. I'm not saying that that has occurred in the state of Alaska, but that is a definite concern. It's not that they may disappear. That gives them time to make changes in the scripts, because when we tell them we're coming, we also tell them, here's what we're looking for. We're going to look at prescriptions from this time period. We want to look at this, you know, 300 prescriptions from the year 2010. So we give them some notice as to what it is we're actually coming in and looking at. And what we don't want to do is give the bad actors, and they're few, but they are out there, the bad actors, the opportunity to go in and basically cook the books, so to speak.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Lombacher. And if you could wrap, please. We've spent now 10 minutes with you. So, and I have nine more people that want to testify. I have one in the chambers that I would like to testify. I'm going to take one other piece of testimony, and I apologize to all you folks online. We're going to continue public testimony on this piece of legislation because we have a whole bunch of folks that want to provide testimony. And I'm going to have, if you can just wrap real quick in like less than 60 seconds, and just to follow up and make it quick, Scott Watts, who runs Apothecary, is next. Mr. Watts.
Well, I won't take up more of your time. I'm certainly available if anyone has questions. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much, Cindy, for coming all the way up here. Mr. Watts, if you can come forward, please. And this is the last piece of public testimony on this bill because we would like to give Representative Feige the opportunity to present his bill. There will be no public testimony on Representative Feige's piece of legislation, but we do want to allow the opportunity for Representative Feige and Linda Hay, his staffer, to at least present the bill and take public testimony at our next meeting. Sorry. Mr. Watts, go ahead.
Okay. Welcome. For the record, my name is Scott Watts. I'm a pharmacist here in Juneau, owner of Ron's Apothecary Shop. And I'd just like to express support for this bill. One thing that's been mentioned is the contracts that we sign with the PBMs, they are pretty much a take it or leave it. We don't have a lot of option on the adjusting the bill or adjusting the contracts. And so setting this out in the this audit bill just puts things on the level playing field for us so that we cannot just be, it feels like taken advantage of on these audits. So I do appreciate your time. And again, the audits are necessary, but if we can be fair, we appreciate that so we can keep helping people.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Watts, for your testimony, and thanks for us. Now you can go back and prescribe.
I'm back there.
Or fill out prescriptions. Great. Thanks, Scott. And that concludes a public testimony on this piece of legislation. Again, it's on hold. We'll continue public testimony as soon as we can do it. Again, we have a conflict next week. There will be many senators that are going to be in Washington, D.C. for Energy Council. However, we're trying to work with the schedule now and see if we can at least have one meeting on Tuesday to try to, sorry, Dan, to at least take more public testimony on these bills. Representative Feige, sorry to keep you waiting so long, and Ms. Hay, if you'd like to come forward as well. Representative Feige, welcome. House Bill 168, Injunction Security Industrial Operation, as a further referral to Judiciary. Thank you very much, Representative Feige.
Thank you, Senator Egan. Appreciate the opportunity to testify here before the committee. This is on the CS for House Bill 168 that came out of the House Judiciary Committee and is titled Injunction Security and Industrial Operation. For the record, my name is Representative Eric Feige. I represent House District 12. Over the past several years, there have been cases where courts have issued injunctions or stays against companies engaged in the development of resource extraction and other large construction projects that have been legally permitted. These court actions have had the effect of delaying worthwhile projects and curtailing employment within the state of Alaska. In some cases, projects have been shut down and employees laid off. Often, the litigation has failed or had an extremely limited effect in hand with the stated objectives of the original lawsuit. The overall objective is often not what is stated in the suit, but is merely a way to delay a project or prevent it from coming to fruition. House Bill 168 seeks to remedy this situation by requiring a party seeking a restraining order, preliminary injunction, or order vacating or staying the operation of a permit that affects an industrial operation to give security in an amount the court considers proper. As the court considers what is proper, House Bill 168 asks that part of their deliberation shall take into account payment of wages and benefits for employees and payment to contractors and subcontractors of the industrial operation. In this legislation, an industrial operation is defined to include a construction, energy, or timber activity and oil, gas, and mineral exploration, development, and production. House Bill 168 parallels the requirements of Alaska Civil Rule 65C, which already requires a court to require a person seeking an injunction to provide security to protect a person who may be wrongfully restrained or enjoined. House Bill 168 does not prohibit a person who is wrongly enjoined from relief or otherwise limit the amount that a person may recover in the action. It also does not specify an amount that is required and does not affect the discretion of the judge to determine that amount. I have been told that the state courts do not see very many of these cases, since most involve federal permits. For those few cases they do see, House Bill 168 seeks to level the legal playing field without infringing on any party's right to bring a legitimate issue to court. With that, I respectfully request your support in passing House Bill 168.
Great. Thank you very much, Representative Feige. And again, our apologies from the committee for scheduling you at the end. We had you scheduled a little. I see you have Linda Hay and your staff. Would she like to provide any additional? No, she says. She says no. Representative Feige, again, we apologize, but you have presented the bill. Then we will have public testimony at our next meeting, and we will alert you if we will be meeting Tuesday or not. We're pulling the committee to see if we're even going to have a quorum. And Representative Feige, you may be even out of town.
I will be, yes.
You will be. Mm-hmm. Well, that ends that. So you will be number one on the list.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Representative Feige. And again, I apologize. We have we don't have enough time to do anything. So anything else to come before the committee? And again, we'll notify members if we do have a quorum and we can meet on Tuesday at least to get some more public testimony. And it would, you know, it may not be an hour and a half, but at least complete the public testimony on the piece of legislation, or two pieces of legislation that we had to cut short. So anything else to come before the committee? We're adjourned.